Hey everyone, welcome to our weekly edition of the Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast. This is Scott Poley here with Tom Costura.
Hello everybody.
And this weekly segment features the top stories that threat hunters need to be thinking about, as well as our thoughts on the subject and hunting strategies. So with that, let's dive into the top threat hunting headlines for the week of January 13th, 2025. What do you got for us, Tom?
All right, kicking it off today, we have an article from Truffle Security titled Millions of Accounts Vulnerable Due to Google's OAuth Flaw.
So they identified that millions of people can have their data stolen right now because of a flaw in Google's sign-in with Google authentication flow. Basic overview here, when you sign in using the sign-in with Google button, Google sends the service you are signing into, like let's use Slack for instance. It sends a set of claims about the user that usually contain two primary things, so the host domain and the user's email. And then the Slack service in this example would then leverage the host domain, leverage that claim to say, okay, this host domain is allowed to log into this workspace. And it would leverage the user's email claim to log into that user's specific account within that given workspace. The rub here is if that domain changes hands, this auth flow has no way of knowing. So let's say a startup had a workspace that was Google-based, and the startup went about its life cycle, and a given workspace or workspaces they use went stale, and I was able to go and purchase like that defunct domain. I now own the same claim information that would allow me to sign in with Google, and I could access information within those workspaces of those accounts. So this can, and through research for the article, would contain all kinds of possible sensitive information like HR data, interview information, PII, like pay stubs, tax documents, social security numbers, many possibilities depending on what the account had access to, what kind of SaaS apps and things were there. So interestingly, within the article, some rough stats of potential reach of this flaw were pointed out. Always into the stats, love seeing that picture kind of painted. So assume we just considered startups. Roughly 6 million Americans actively work for startups. 90% of startups tend to fail, and 50% of those startups rely on Google Workspaces. So per the article, some digging into Crunchbase's startup data set led to a find of more than 100,000 domains from failed startups that were available for purchase. So, you know, using any kind of rough math or estimate you want to go against this. So using what the article did, assuming there's 10 employees / accounts per startup, you crawl into the millions of potential accounts and information that are within reach of risk. So one note, you know, touching on one point of mitigation, this is one I thought had more meat in it. There was a couple other talking points in this, but anyone kind of looking to protect against this flaw moving forward, a couple mitigations are mentioned. So disable the password-based authentication and enforce SSO with two-factor auth would help. Also, service providers should set requirements for additional verification for anything for account resets. So like adding on top of it SMS codes or other verification methods within it. So, I mean, this is kind of a quick and dirty, Scott, and I thought it was a fun read. This was also presented at SmooCon, the most recent SmooCon, and the article contains a talk as well for anyone that's interested in kind of, you know, hearing it from the mouth of babes. But yeah, you know, what are your thoughts on this one, Scott?
No, I mean, I thought it was interesting. Because I don't typically use OAuth myself, just because I feel like I like to have control of that piece of my security, I guess. And one of the things that I thought was also interesting was, I guess this was presented to Google as a, hey, a potential issue. And it got responded as a don't fix kind of thing or won't fix, because it didn't seem like such a big enough flaw for them. And then after the SmooCon talk, it seemed like they changed their stance, and then we're working on, you know, making a fix for this. And I think it's kind of important, because when I think of something as common as OAuth, where it's supposed to make things very convenient, right? It needs to be really robust. And not saying this is like a glaring gap, but what is concerning is if you are concerned about this and you no longer control that your old domain, you can't regain control of any of those accounts that, you know, you've basically lost through losing that domain. So you kind of just have to, you're kind of stuck in that perspective. And the other is, you know, it's one of those vulnerabilities or whatever you want to call it, that is really more opportunistic, I would say, right? Like I don't think most people, if they were to try to leverage this, know what they're going to be gaining access to, because there's a lot of pieces you'd have to connect. First, you'd have to own the domain. Then you have to figure out how the email was actually structured for the users after you find the users that then work potentially at the startup, you know, example, and structure it the same way, you know, first initial, last name, whatever they did. And then try to log in with that, but know what SaaS applications they were even using that were using, you know, so like there's a huge grab bag to go after. But I do think, you know, when we design solutions that are supposed to be really convenient, they should be robust so that things like this don't come up. And as small as this is, it's good to put a second set of eyes on things and for them to go back and say, are we thinking about all the edge cases? Because, you know, OAuth existed and technology and how we use technology starts to evolve. So does OAuth, right? In a way. So I think it's just a good example of understanding the technology, interesting find, understanding the risk so we can paint it correctly. And I can understand where Google's stance was, but I also think it's something that we should just have a really good solution. So why not fix it, figure out what other things we can fix along the process. So yeah, it's kind of cool.
It's interesting to me too. And I'm going to speak just on conversation point here because I didn't do the research or I haven't done the research yet, at least, but I was curious on the point that when you have something like a Google Workspace and let's say your startup, you know, belly up, for example, like you just have a startup, you're using this, you get into play for this potential flaw. It's interesting to me that your startup would fail, set down, et cetera. Your domain would just be up for grabs. And then all of that stuff still lives in play. There's no like exit strategy from the Google side. I'm assuming there's got to be somehow, and maybe that's just like not completed by the person who had these assets. But if that's interesting to me, that there's kind of a gap in my brain to understand that, like why,
like how you can unenroll everybody if they use those accounts.
Your company shuts, you know, folds up, shuts up shop.
Why doesn't all that stuff go away? Like you're I would assume you're not still paying for it. I would assume you're not under contract anymore. Why is it still there and accessible in such an easy manner? That's weird. Yeah, to me.
There may be a way, like, you know, if someone leaves the company, you usually kind of leave that access around because you may need something that they had access to, right? So I can see why.
True. Yeah.
Right. I can see why things would linger. And maybe there is a mechanism. This is why Google wasn't as concerned, where you can basically unenroll people, right? And then people just weren't using it. So then it's really an education problem on top of all this. I'm not sure because I haven't created my own startup and haven't created workspaces to manage them this way. So it'd be interesting to see if what comes of this. But yeah, I mean, it's a good point, right? Like, you know, it's just managing assets at that point from a company perspective. And even if a company goes under, right, there's still assets that need to be managed in that process, right? So.
Correct. Yeah. And I would think like, then you start thinking about like, who's actually liable for this? Like, is it necessarily a Google problem or is it the, you know, the asset owner's problem?
Mm-hmm.
All right, what do you got here, Scott? What's next?
So the first one to kick off with, I thought was really interesting. It was from Halcyon. I don't know how you say that.
I was saying it Halcyon.
Halcyon, we'll go with it. They had a blog, and it was called Abusing AWS Native Service Ransomware Encrypting S3 Buckets with SSE-C. Basically, they reported on there was a threat actor they're calling Codefinger that was compromising AWS keys and leveraging those keys, basically, you know, access to encrypt S3 buckets data using the SSE-C, which is basically server-side encryption with a customer key. And so essentially you can have your keys in AWS to encrypt things, or you can provide a key to encrypt things and then you hold the keys locally on your side. So they're basically leveraging the AWS encryption infrastructure. So there's no generated key. And then they also, on top of that, were marking all the files that they encrypted for deletion after 7 days with the Object Lifecycle Management API, which kind of, you know, adds that urgency of like, hey, if you don't do anything, your stuff's going to get completely destroyed, not just encrypted. So it was interesting, right? Because, you know, this is something that people talk about when it comes to cloud-based security. It's all about how do you control access, right, is the first piece. So they're able to get their hands on these keys. They didn't talk about how these keys may have been compromised or whatever it is, or the accounts that got compromised. But one of the things they mentioned was the attacker made a point to validate if they had access to put or get objects within the S3 buckets, right? And so when you start looking at, okay, you don't know, you can do, there's a lot of standard security when it comes to, hey, this key was logged in or this account was logged in from here and now they're logged in from here. So change the location, change the time, all that kind of stuff. There's some built-in alerting for things like that. But you also have to think about if someone does get access and their intention is to do this, first they got to validate to have those privileges, right? And there's and all the interactions within AWS are done via API calls. So there's a whole API infrastructure that lets you basically perform every single action. Even if you're actually in the GUI, you're leveraging like an API in the back end to even perform everything. So everything gets logged the same way, and it's very easily and well documented as far as what is being done and what can be done. But there is one API that I don't know if they used it, but some things to be aware of. If they're trying to check if they have the right access to even do these things, one of the things they can do is there's an API called simulate dash principal dash policy, which basically says, hey, I want to not necessarily complete this task, but I want to pretend to complete this task and see if any errors come back, right? And so you can basically simulate what you want to do. And then when you do it, it'll say, oh, it failed, and it'll fail because you don't have the privileges, or it'll say this would succeed kind of thing, right? It's a great way to profile what access an account has. So a good thing to pay attention to. Also, if you have the user, you can also run the API that's list attached user policies. And then provide the username that you have access to, right? And it will list all the policies that are assigned, and then you can say get policy version of those specific policies to get a more detailed explanation of what those policies consist of. So you got to realize there's going to be some account profiling unless they're just going to just try the action and see if it fails. That might be something different, but that might set off alerting that they may be trying to avoid. And so one of the things that is interesting is a lot of times AWS bucket thing data you can control with access controllers or ACLs, right? As far as how that data is managed, but you can actually encrypt them without even touching or modifying an ACL. You can just basically add when you're doing like a put object, for instance, you can basically add the dash SSE customer algorithm and an AES encryption, Base64 encoded key, whatever you want to put with it, to basically pass that key. But something to note, right, is if you're going to encrypt a bucket full of information, you're going to have to list all those objects and call them individually by key. So there is some batch type approach where you would see a lot of activity with everything being listed, captured, and then everything being done. And I don't know in AWS if there's some sort of control where if there's so many things it can like kind of pause the actions or, you know, whatever, but that's another telling sign something is happening and probably happening right now when they're listing out objects and then have to call them individually by key. So if you have a big data repo, right, maybe you can stop it before the whole thing completes, but, you know, machine speeds is kind of tough. And sometimes I did read that there's like the time to live for connections and also some of the throughput in the calls, they can get throttled. So that might, if you have a large data store, you might have to actually break it up in batches if they want to encrypt the whole thing. So you might actually have more time than you think to respond if this activity is actually going on. But I thought it was a good call out to a real example of where kind of this ransomware encryption approach is being leveraged. And just like we've seen in most systems, a lot of times people use kind of lay of the land things. And if you can just use the native encryption in the cloud, why attackers are going to use that. So yeah, it's a good way to think about it. You know, there's some good things to look for, I think, and be prepared for. And, you know, account access is important, especially if you're concerned about your data or there's specific S3 buckets that you have that, you know, are storing more sensitive data. You probably want to audit those a little more as far as when are things being accessed and who's accessing and responding quicker to things that may get alerted that way. But yeah, it was an interesting read. Pretty sweet, cut and dry.
Yeah, I thought it was when I see stuff like this, and it's not to shout like sky is falling, but I feel like when we start seeing, and we've talked about some over the last few months, attacks on
you know, cloud assets. And when you see something like this with ransomware in the cloud and kind of like, you know, seemingly not overwhelmingly complicated, it's a little scary. But what I mean to say that to is that I hope people are taking note of this. I hope groups are, you know, organizations and asset owners are thinking about this, because we've also talked about many times in the past about how the different types of cloud assets, SaaS applications, all the different things that you can do, you know, are really mostly developed for easy spin up, for quick to market, for ease of use, for, you know, a lot of different functionality with limited overhead. I think the fact that we don't talk about this more, see this more, plays into that, if you know what I mean. So it's interesting to see this. I hope people are taking note of this a little bit, at least to have conversations internally to say, okay, well, maybe we should consider this, because maybe we haven't even thought about this yet inside of our environment and what could be possible. I also, you know, a little note too, at the ransom note portion of this was interesting, where it kind of, you know, had your traditional ransom note, but then it also said, listen, if you change the account permissions, we're just going to stop talking to you and your data is encrypted forever. It was kind of interesting. Like, hey, we know you could do this, but if you do it, you're lost. But yeah, no, it's pretty cool. Pretty cool article. Something to touch on. I know I was going high level there, Scott, but it gets me thinking every time, like, are people having conversations about how to protect their cloud assets? Because I have a feeling not as much as maybe they should.
Yeah. And, you know, you bring up a point where they're using the tools as they're intended to be used. So that's why it's easy for the attacker. And when things like that happen, I always think, well, if it's that easy for the attacker, it should be almost just as easy as the defender to defend against it. Because, you know, when I see an attack that's like they're using some like rootkit based thing, all API calls, there's no data that touches disk, all this kind of stuff. As a defender, I'm like, well, crap, what do I do with that? I don't know where I'll see it or how I'll see it and how I can respond to it. But when they're blatantly doing actions that I would see in my data and the way that access might be non-standard and something like, I'm like, I should know what good looks like in this in this context. And so there's a lot I could identify bad, right? So, you know, that's my takeaway when I see things that, you know, appear easy, so to speak.
Yeah. And we've seen too in the past too, where like, you know, people will go in and they'll leverage these assets and, you know, it's like, oh yeah, you know, you have this whole setup, you get an idea for what it is, Amazon, you know, Google, Microsoft, whomever. And you have this kind of like blanketed, yeah, everything's good. It's a nice box. It's a real package. But, and you get kind of a comfortability there to where maybe you're just not looking because you're like, hey, it's, you know, it's secure. They got it. But still, yeah, no, I mean, it's a good point. So it's like, yeah, the easy stuff you should be able to see right away. You just got to consider looking, right?
Right, right.
All right. So moving on to number three this week. So a blog post from Horizon3.ai titled Critical Vulnerabilities in Simple Help Remote Support Software. So most of us have experienced or heard, particularly last year, various remote support tools that had vulnerabilities that were actively exploited. So a couple of the high level ones were like ConnectWise, Scrim Connect, and then Beyond Trust was a big one. And with that in mind, researchers at Horizon 3 decided to poke around the internet to kind of see what other remote support tools were out in the wild and possibly being exploited. And they stumbled across a tool called Simple Help. It's not one that I've heard of before. And I've spent some time looking at some of these types of tools in the past. But they found this one and dug in, and they seen a decent user base. And then they went in and did some more research and identified multiple vulnerabilities that could be used to compromise that tool from the server and the client side. So basically, real quick, hitting on these at a high level, there are three distinct vulnerabilities that they reported. So an unauthenticated path traversal, which basically would allow download of arbitrary files from the Simple Help server. And they would contain things like a config file that contained hash passwords for various accounts, like the admin or support accounts, or other files that contained LDAP creds, client secrets, API keys, other things. Lots of juice there. The next vulnerability was an arbitrary file upload to remote code execute as admin. And once logged in as admin or a support account, an attacker could upload like things like ground type files to execute code or overwrite executables to achieve RC. And then another vulnerability, allowing privilege escalations from support accounts to server admin. So this has been reported to Simple Help, and the patches have already been released. So for any of you out there that are unaware of these issues and using this tool, any version build, before 2025 is likely to be exploitable. Anything lower than versions 5.58, 5.4.10, or 5.3.9, if you get through that, sorry, Scott, are likely exploitable. But a little kind of like a branch off of this, because this one, when I seen it, it had me thinking just from, you know, old wounds, I guess. And me thinking about past experiences, fighting similar issues of remote support tools. There's so many out there, and these tools seem to, you know, there constantly seems to be new types of remote support tools. And many I've seen in the past that aren't even like properly categorized, where like app control could prevent the use of them. They'll run easily, launch from temp. They're not identified, things like that. And you pair that with like various social engineering attacks and users trying to do things they probably shouldn't, or getting tricked into downloading these tools, and you kind of have a nice little recipe for compromise. So I thought it was worth bringing up today because the article is interesting. That one, I love that the researchers kind of made that pivot, because I know in previous SOC experience, we did that internally, and it was kind of a fun, unstructured hunt, if you will. In digging in your environment and seeing what might be there in the category of remote support tools, like just finding out what kind are out there, looking around in your environment for them. Maybe it's building a detection. Maybe it's diving through historical data, asking questions like, why are they there? Should they be? Understanding how often they're used, what kind of users were allowing them to be used? Did they allow external access to the machine in an environment to an untrusted third party? The possible fines can kind of go on and on. I know in experience, in my personal experience, when going down this rabbit hole, you actually, like, I've uncovered stuff where there were remote support tools that didn't even know of, but it was relative to a very specific vendor. They only use that remote support tool. Not necessarily a malicious thing, but definitely worth knowing, right? So you can understand the inner workings of your environment. So that's like one of those kind of off the limb finds when you're hunting. And you know, there's other things too. You find where people, you know, you didn't necessarily see what had happened, and you see somebody that let somebody access their machine because they were tricked, and it was some goofy call center in India or some random, really obscure remote access tool that was, you know, they got hooked by. So yeah, you know, I thought it was worth pivoting off this. I know it's kind of high level, but still, sometimes it's worth talking about that, especially considering when you're thinking about hunting and maybe you don't know where to go. This is one of those, like, in my mind, low hanging fruit. You could just like, hey, this is the topic I want to go down. And you could start throwing darts at the wall on this one. Hey, I want to go find 10 remote support tools that are out there. Let me get 5 known ones, 5 obscure ones, and let me dig in my environment and see if any of those IOCs click, and then start looking in. Once they do, what were they doing? Were they supposed to be there? All those things. So yeah, you know, interesting article to me. It rung home, hit on a couple scars, a couple old wounds. But, you know, what about you, Scott? What are you thinking?
So if I can keep my thoughts together, there are like 3 things you made me think of. And one, to just jump on when you talk about kind of the unstructured approach to these things, is kind of good and fun to go through. I think it's a great place to start if you're not a really experienced hunter that can come up with the hypothesis of the different techniques and behaviors you're specifically trying to look for. These broad hypotheses that let you just kind of explore and dig into your data are like really valuable for a green hunter to just basically say, I'm learning the environment, I'm also potentially identifying a problem and understanding something, because that's ultimately what the process is kind of about anyways, except for structure just gets more like tip of the spear of the problem. So the other thing is, you know, from an adversary perspective, I really like this article because they're like, hey, we realize there is this remote admin tool. We don't really know much more about it. They discover how prevalent it is as far as scanning, you know, the globe, right? And the internet. And then they start diving into, well, what vulnerabilities are associated with this? Because since it's a remote admin tool or remote, you know, tool, that means access. And adversaries do the same thing. That's why you see more vulnerabilities released for like firewalls and VPN concentrators and remote admin tools, because that's their approach too. They're going to spend their resources trying to figure out vulnerabilities for the things that are exposed. Then if there's some obscure thing within your environment, that vulnerability is not as important. Now, if researchers or other people kind of discover those because now there's a reason and a value, that's when they start looking at vulnerabilities for like major internal applications. But all the external stuff, this process doesn't go on a lot. But not just going back to people being social engineered for remote admin tools. I know plenty of like contractors for managing systems or hardware or, you know, HVAC, you know, for instance, like the Target attack, right? Like these people will put remote type software in an environment so they can help assist and manage and do all the things they need to do. But the one thing they're not doing is maintaining them, right? So the remote software might be okay, but if you don't know it's there and they're not going to care to update things and everything like that, because one, if it breaks on an update, it's more of a pain for them to just to go out and fix multiple sites everywhere that aren't even like local potentially, right? So that's something to really be aware of too, because I know some serious instances where people didn't know and the implications and the amount of access that actually opened up to really critical parts of, you know, operation, that could be really bad. So also being aware of that, that's why knowing about these tools and looking for these tools or identifying things in your environment and then understanding why they're there to begin with, like you mentioned, are I think are really valuable points. Because yeah, there might even be devices that necessarily aren't even yours, but they exist in your ecosystem. And so under the purview of an organization, you might not say, well, we don't manage this. This isn't ours. Well, what risk does that bring to you? Like, do you know enough about it? Right. Even those instances are important. So yeah, it was an interesting, approach. I liked kind of seeing how they started one place and walked all the way through and highlighted some things that we should be kind of aware of and thinking about in general.
Yeah. Yeah. And we talk about and we work pretty much day in and day out, really kind of try to develop these well-defined hunts, you know, as much detail as with the maximum amount of accuracy as possible, and testing them against true and live fire stuff. But you know, there's always room when you talk about hunt and what you're doing to these kinds of thought processes. And they can get even more, like, they can stay broad and still get more defined if you talk about implementing them into a specific environment. So everybody's environment's different. Everything you care about is going to be different from the next guy. So applying some of that, even from that level, thinking in this kind of light of going after something that you might care about in your environment, but you don't have that high accuracy point yet or that high detailed attack definition that you might be looking for, you can still attack it in this light. So I like bringing that up once in a while, right? Because we want our hunters to think about that, right?
Right, absolutely.
So all right, what's this you got last for, Scott?
Yeah, this next one, once again, I picked something I might butcher the pronunciation, but it's a blog from Sequoia.io. And it's titled Double Tap Campaign, Russia Nexus APT, possibly related to an APT-28, conducts cyber espionage on Central Asia and Kazakhstan diplomatic relations. It's interesting because basically it was a phishing example, right? But the chain of events in the phishing was very interesting, but also the documents that were leveraged were also very interesting. So I kind of want to take a step back to talk about that. They actually were leveraging real official Kazakhstan documents that they had acquired at some point, drafts or whatever, and then weaponized those to send as part of phishing. So from a social engineering perspective, using real documents and real things obviously can be a very powerful tool. And there's no call to exactly how they got these documents, but taking a step back, when you think of nation state activity, one of the things that motivates nation states in general is just positioning, right? So, you know, you have ransomware operators and people looking for money. It's very opportunistic sometimes. Who could we get access to? Who has enough money? Who can go after? Nation states kind of opportunistic in a different way, but it's about positioning. Is there something that you can gain a lot that can help you down the line or in the future, and with very little risk, right? So that's why a lot of times nation states gain access to things that you normally be like, that doesn't make any sense. Or, you know, they understand what's going on in the world, so timing can mean everything. And hey, there's this huge commotion happening in this part of the world. They're all worried about this. Maybe we can leverage that because people aren't paying attention and we can do these things, or we can leverage this to help in some other things we're trying to do. Like, you know, they're always thinking positioning. Because they want to be in a good position so when they need something that's of key importance, it's readily available, right? Because that becomes capability at that point. So I thought that was interesting that they're able to use potentially documents that from other campaigns that they had acquired and then turn around and use them for this because of their motivation as far as not getting the same amount of support because of the Ukraine war stuff going on. But now the talk about the actual phishing, I guess, attempt, right? What was interesting about this is Windows now has macros disabled, right, by default. But they actually send a document, and it has a macro that the user has to basically launch. And its only action is to disable that registry key, so there is no user prompt to enable anything and all that kind of stuff naturally. And they use shapes. So I didn't know what it's actually called when you open up a document and the document's hidden. And you know you have to like accept this or whatever in order to like get through. I didn't know that was called, but that's called shapes. So they use shapes basically, so it looks like you know it's password protected, and you have to put something in. But really, all that's doing is telling, disabling that registry key. But what's crazy is once that happens, it also the macro opens up a second document that it pulls down. That has another malicious macro, but now all the controls that are supposed to protect or warn about macros is gone, so that this document can actually successfully run. And so when it runs, then it runs an HTA file. Well, it creates a scheduled task that will then run an HTA file that basically then has the payload for the final communication back to the C2 and everything like that. So I thought it was really interesting because not only that, I've never seen where a Word document pulls down another Word document that then opens it hidden so you don't see it. But the first Word document is really just to disable the controls, and the second one is supposed to actually deliver the payload. I thought that was a really kind of fancy approach. So you're not really changing much of your normal attack chain. You're just modifying it, right? And breaking it up. And you know, this is why obfuscation works so well, right? It's like the same attack happening. It's just displayed differently, or you know, hidden a little differently. But obviously, if you see MSHTA being launched from a service, so service.exe is launching it, that might be suspect because that's not typical for a lot of services to be launching web apps as a process. But then if you even see VBA, or you know, VBA would be what is it WScript? I can't remember now. Or is it just VBScript? Maybe it's VBScript.exe. But one of those two, when it's launching either MSHTA and things like that, also suspect. And then if you see Word launching Word, which I haven't verified that's the process chain in this, but that would be also concerning or weird behavior, I would think. But end all, be all, when they finally get everything set up, they pull down Cherry Spy, which is I guess their kind of remote malware kind of rat tool. But really the big thing here was just kind of calling out, you know, the different types of activity they leverage in a kind of what you would call a traditional phishing attack that I thought was, one, easily fingerprintable in a way, right? Because I haven't seen many attacks that do this many levels or steps. And I thought it was really interesting to have, you know, one, like I said, breaking down the controls in one manner so that it doesn't have the same alerting before you actually do the thing that you don't want to get caught with as another step. So, yeah, what were your thoughts?
Yeah, the shapes thing, I didn't know that was the definition of it either. So you're not alone on that. I was I was like, what is shapes? Like when I read it initially, I'm like, and then when I'm like, oh, okay, yeah, I know what that is. I just never heard it called that before. Yeah, you know, the hidden part. So I like this whole double tap piece. I think it's kind of neat. In this scenario specifically, I'm talking about where that first email really just changes the registry key. So when you hit that button for allowing the macro to run, there's really no alarm that's set off necessarily, unless you have something that's really looking for that, which I think helps like embed the attack, right? That's that methodology of like, okay, I'm doing this, I click this, there's, you know, you might as an end user be like hesitant, but you're like, oh, you know, whatever. And you click through the thing and then nothing happens. So you're like, oh, okay, we're all good. And then it does its thing in the background. It's kind of a simplistic, but really cool thought process of how to, you know, leverage against human behavior or potential human behavior as far as defending. I had interest in the one section where they talked about the overlap with APT28 related ZebraC group, which is the subgroup of APT28 where they see a lot of the techniques used in this with the double tap document, the CT used in PHP, the specific register T's that were modified, and the creation of the scheduled tasks, you know, all the same methodologies. I don't think they're necessarily specific, because we see those overlap with different things from time to time, but it was a cool call out. I'm always interested in those. And then I thought in the article, for those listening, there's some cool stuff at the bottom when it talks about like detection opportunities. So they list out a few sigmas that look for the behavior that's happening here. So it's relatively easily to translate if you wanted to look at it to leverage for detections or hunting. But yeah, this is a good article. I like the technique, man, and now I know what shapes means. So thanks, Scott.
Yeah, I just think of like the person behind the attack when he's like been doing this for like 20 years, where he just sends a Word document that has a malicious macro, and they're like, "What are we gonna do?" And he's like, "What if we just do two documents? You know, like two dragons." Right. So they're like, "Oh, that's brilliant." It's like, you know, it's just the guy that's using what he does well, even better, right? Doesn't have to reinvent the wheel.
Quick Shrek reference, man. I can imagine these guys sitting in their wherever they're at, and looking at each other like, what if it's like an onion? What if we had layers? You know, like ogres have layers, so this will work. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
All right, so that kind of closes us out. One thing I want to remind everybody that we have coming up, we have our live podcast edition happening January 30th from 12 to 1:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. The big topic there is we're going to be really discussing threat intel and how to operationalize that into threat hunting. Like, what does good threat intel look like for that, and things to be aware of. So I think it'll be a fun and exciting discussion. Because I do hear people talk about this in general as far as how do they mature things, and it usually comes back to those two pieces. So make sure to check that out and keep your eyes on some of the socials. You'll see it being advertised and mentioned. So with that, I really want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast episode today. Looking forward to thinking back up next week. So with that, it closes out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of January 13th, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.